Is the Bible reliable truth? Welcome to this portion of Vocal Point. I'm Jerry Newcomb, and right now our guest is Richard Simmons III, who's written a book about that. It's called Reliable Truth, The Validity of the Bible in an Age of Skepticism. Richard, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Jerry.
Sure. And before we get into an overview of your book, tell us about your own personal faith journey, because I understand at one point you yourself were a skeptic.
Yeah, I did. I grew up in a home that that was, I guess you could call, nominally Christian and believed in the Bible. And I went through a real period of questioning that, but most significantly, questioning the actual validity of the Bible. I mean, if I would ask a question of how do we know the Bible is the Word of God, I never would get any good answers, and that really kind of led me on this quest to really kind of bring to light why should we believe that the Bible is the Word of God, and that's how this came about.
Well, how many years would you say that you were skeptical?
Not as many as you might think. I was really in my college years is where I guess you could say was my greatest skepticism, and then I came to Christ when I was 20. And yet still, even as the years went by as a Christian, I still wondered. There was something in me, even though the Bible had the ring of truth to it, I still wondered, how do we know this really is the Word of God? And it led me on a long, journey of researching this, and then ended up giving, I do a lot of public speaking, I gave a number of presentations on the material that's in the book, and it was so impacted people, they says, you've got to convert this into a book, and that's how it came about.
Oh, neat. Okay, well, let me ask you this. First of all, as a skeptic, were you actually reading the book itself? Because a lot of times there are people who say, I don't believe that stuff anymore, or, whatever. But they're not even familiar with it, really.
Yeah, I was not reading it, and I was, in college, I was taking some religion courses that took pot shots at the Bible, and I was not really in it. I did start reading some books that really kind of God used to really draw me to Himself.
Because, such as?
I tell you, the book and really the speaker that had such an impact on me was Josh McDowell. This was when he was had just come out with Evidence That Demands a Verdict, and then I read another book. We're talking about 40 years now. It's been so long. I can't remember which one it was, but God used it in my life. He really did.
Mere Christianity, C.S. Lewis.
I did read that. That was terrific.
Okay.
That was terrific.
All right. So if I were to go to your seminar or if I were to read your book, Reliable Truth or whatever, what would I learn in, we have about 10 minutes or 12 minutes to unpack this.
Okay.
So go ahead.
All right. First of all, I spend the opening parts of the book talking about just really more how so many people regard the Bible as being myth and legend. And I try to tackle that right off the bat. And I go into how so many people are guilty of what's called irresponsible disbelief. And irresponsible disbelief is where so many people choose to disbelieve in something without any significant commitment to investigate that which they didn't believe. And I use as an example Dr. Francis Collins, who is considered probably one of the greatest scientists in the world today. And he talks about how, as an atheist, he realized at a certain point that he had never collected any kind of data as it relates to his faith. He said, I always did that in science, but I never had ever looked into anything as far as the issues of faith. And he says, bottom line, I didn't have much integrity as an atheist. Then I spent a significant amount of time talking about the Bible and history, because I think that's so important, is how does the biblical record, how does it fare with secular history, and that's a very important chapter, I believe. Then I go straight from there, because it's related, into archaeology, because archaeology has something to do with history, but it also is considered a science, and I think it's a very, very important chapter and very, very important issue, because biblical archaeology is a fairly new science. Most people don't realize it, but it's been able to confirm places and events that people think were part of a mythological world. And for instance, they can prove, you know, that David existed, that Moses existed, that the Hittites and that you read about in Genesis, and where it's really kind of blown a lot of people away, particularly the skeptic. Then I think some of the most important parts of the book, Jerry, relates to science, and I have a really, really, I think, powerful chapter on the Bible as it relates to the world of science, and I would say that. And I try to make this, as I'm sitting here sharing this with you, one of my goals in writing the book was I wanted to write a scholarly book that was easy to read. For instance, my 17-year-old daughter read it this summer, and she said, "Dad, I'm so glad you asked me to read this book, encouraged me to read it, because as a Christian," she said, "I've never told you this, but I've often wondered, is the Bible really true, or are these stories true that you read about in the Bible?" And she said, "This convinced me that they are." And so, you know, that is a big, big part of it. Then I get into the issue of the Bible and morality. I think that's an important issue.
Mm-hmm.
And then I get, at the very end, I talk about, so when it gets right down to it, how do we really know that the Bible is the Word of God? And I've laid out all this evidence that I feel like is quite compelling. But if you think about it, any sacred religious books that claim to be the true Word of God, you know, where and how do they get the authority to make that claim? I mean, what ultimately makes it legitimate? I mean, whether it's the Quran or the Bhagavad Gita of the Hindu or the Bible itself, how can you make that claim? And that's where I think the Bible is set apart, because we believe the Bible is the Word of God for one primary reason, and that is because Jesus says that it was. If you think about it, Jesus validates that God has chosen the written Word as his primary means of revelation, because he puts his stamp of approval on the Old Testament. I mean, 92 different times he will say it is written, or he says God has said, and he quotes the Old Testament. And then before he leaves, he appoints these special men who were his disciples, other than Judas, who kills himself, and then Matthias, who takes his place, and Jesus appoints them as apostles, and they were to record what they'd seen and heard, and even expound upon his teachings. And this is kind of how we end up with the Bible. And so the question really changes from not is the Bible the Word of God, but was Jesus the Son of God? And so I end with, I think, the most important chapter, and that is, how do we know Jesus was the Son of God? And I feel like I make a very, very strong argument with four main points on how we know Jesus truly was the Son of God.
Okay, and those four points in summary are?
In summary was that Jesus, basically, look at his impact on history. I mean, even the great skeptics agree that he has had the greatest impact on history more than any other person, whether it's H.G. Wells, W.H. Leckie, Will Durant, and I talk about that at length. Then I think it's crucial to look at and study carefully the fulfillment of the Old Testament messianic prophecies. And I go into great detail, and I have several examples of Jewish scholars who completely changed their mind and became Christians because of that. Then a third, of course, is the evidence for the resurrection, and I take a little different approach than most people on that. And then finally, and I think very significantly, is how Jesus changed the world, not through power and wealth, but through a humble life. And I love this quote from Napoleon, who said, "You know, I die before my time, and my body shall be given back to the earth and devoured by worms. What an abysmal gulf between my deep miseries and the eternal kingdom of Christ. I marvel that whereas the ambitious dreams of myself and of Alexander the Great and of Julius Caesar should have vanished into thin air, and yet a Judean peasant, Jesus, should be able to stretch his hands across the centuries and control the destinies of men and nations."
Wow.
And so that's how I close up the book.
Wow, that's super. I had the privilege of writing a book with Dr. Kennedy many years ago called What If Jesus Had Never Been Born? And it touches on that first and the last point about the Jesus part, which is the impact of Jesus Christ on planet Earth. We would not enjoy life had Jesus never been born, if we were even alive. You said that Jewish scholars, in some cases, embraced messianic prophecies, or they recognized and discovered Jesus in the Old Testament and then became believers in Jesus. Who do you have in mind, or who do you cite as an example?
Well, one of them, I don't know that you would call it. Let me put it this way. They're both scholars today. One of them, this happened in college, so I guess I need to probably clarify that. He was a All-American football player at UCLA, and he tells the story of how someone, a campus ministry, challenged him to go take his Jewish Bible and look up these verses and see if they don't point to the fact that Christ was the Messiah, that they don't point to Jesus being the fulfillment of these prophecies. And when he read them, he was shocked. Mm-hmm. And he went to his rabbi. It's kind of funny. And he said, "Rabbi, who is this they talk about in Isaiah 53? Because it sure seems to be pointing to Jesus." And he says, the rabbi gave him a very lame answer. He says, "You know, it does seem to be pointing to the fact that Jesus is the Son of God, but because we don't believe that Jesus was the Messiah, we just don't buy this." And he said that was what led him. He realized that basically he felt like most Jews he was totally unaware of this, but he said it was like this rabbi was sticking his head in the sand, and that was what ultimately, of course, God worked in his life that brought him to Christ. Another guy is a guy by the name of Jerry Levinson, and it's a very powerful, his story is very powerful as well.
You know, Isaiah 53, I've talked to Jewish believers in Jesus who, grew up and so forth, and they say that Isaiah 53 generally, it's just never read in the synagogues. It's so obviously talking about Jesus Christ, but it was written 750 to 700 B.C., and, it's 13, I believe it's 13 verses, so powerfully and, again, pointing directly to Jesus. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. That's one of the statements in that chapter. You mentioned earlier science. You have a whole chapter about science. Talk about that, please.
Yeah, the thing about science that's so interesting is that there are three ways to view the relationship between science and faith or science and the Bible. The first is that, as some of the new atheists believe, that basically they're at war with each other. Richard Dawkins takes that position. The second view is that really that science and the Bible, or science and God and religion, they have nothing to do with each other. They're two separate and distinct realms that don't intersect. But what you're seeing more and more is more as a third view, and that is that you're particularly seeing this in cosmology, but in also other areas of science, that science is now beginning to really point to, it doesn't prove, but it's pointing us to the existence of God. And I go through the example of Anthony Flew, who was one of the world's most notorious atheists, who completely changed his mind. And he says one of the main reasons he changed his mind is because of what's going on in the world of science. If you think about it, Jerry, in the book I talk about this this research that was done by Pew, and they did a polling of a large number of scientists in our country on the existence of God. 51% of them said they do believe in God, 41% said they do not, 8% said they don't know. Now, if you think about it, if science could prove that God exists, or could prove that he doesn't exist, then all 100% of them would be atheists. But that's not the case. And so I think when you get right down to it, you need to recognize that people who say that science now disproves the existence of God, that doesn't hold water at all.
Well, and also, as you well know, science as we know it was actually invented by Christians, in the late Middle Ages and the beginning of the Reformation. As Johannes Kepler, the great astronomer, put it, we scientists are thinking God's thoughts after him. And I think that's a great point. Do you have a website for the book?
Well, of course, you can buy the book on Amazon.com, or you can go to the organization that I work for. It's called the Center for Executive Leadership, and the website is www.thecenter.org.
As in Birmingham, Alabama.
as in Birmingham, Alabama. That's
all right. And the name of the book again is Reliable Truth, The Validity of the Bible in an Age of Skepticism by Richard Simmons III, who's been our guest. Thank you so much, Richard. God bless you.
Thank you, Jerry.
All right. Bye-bye now.